This is Howard Husick, Vice President for Policy Research at the Manhattan Institute and the moderator of our Center for the American University's March 28th event entitled Kangaroo Courts on Campus, Yale, Duke, and Due Process, featuring attorney Harvey Silverglate of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education and Professor Casey Johnson of the Brooklyn College. The program focused on concerns about the lack of legal due process for students involved in campus disciplinary hearings, such as those regarding alleged sexual misconduct and other charges. This is the second of two podcast recordings drawn from the remarks of the speakers and from the lively question and answer period which followed their remarks. Peter, over here.
Peter Selton. Many of the high-profile, egregious cases seem to be in private universities. The Duke case that you mentioned, Yale, and there was one at University of Pennsylvania, I think that had to do with yelling out a window or something. But is there any difference either in the way the universities conduct themselves or in the potential legal response that you might have between public universities and private universities?
Well, public universities, in theory, are governed by constitutional limitations. That is, the Bill of Rights, free speech, due process apply to public institutions. They don't apply to private institutions, although liberal arts private institutions do have internal rules, internal obligations, because once you say you're a liberal arts university, you believe in academic freedom, blah, 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 you have a kind of contractual relationship with your students and with the public that you have to deliver what you claim you stand for. And so there are limitations in theory on the totalitarian impulses of both public university administrators and private university administrators. The trouble is that they don't know that, they don't act as if they know it, they lose a lawsuit every so often, and that doesn't register at all because they don't pay out of their own pockets, and so it goes on. So the theory and the practice are like day and night.
Right, Michael over here.
Famously, universities gave up on what they called in loco parentis, whenever it was, in the late 60s, early 70s, and today, you know, there seems to be, on the one hand, no attempt to control student behavior when it comes to binge drinking, co-ed dorms, the hookup culture, et cetera. But on the other hand, you're describing plausibly this coercive attempt by the university to control all kinds of other behavior that maybe is a consequence of abandoning in loco parentis. And I'm wondering if you see a connection or any way to untangle the paradox.
It's an excellent question. I would say that there's less a connection than a contradiction, especially on sexual assault misconduct cases, that a lot of the pressure on this has come from either faculty members or from administrators who are sort of buying into a diversity inclusion agenda that we associate with these faculty members, who have been pushing a kind of sexual libertine theory in their scholarship, but at the same time, they have no trouble with authoritarian policies. They seem to see, I think, no contradiction between these episodes at all, and I suspect that if they had to choose, they would choose the authoritarian policy. I mean, Harvey's point is really well taken here, that in the end, these people like power, and they like being able to exercise power. And you know, on this issue of culture, if you don't have a good board and you don't have a good a senior administrator at CUNY, we're lucky we do. The chances of success are very small.
Thank you. I was inspired to go to law school by Harvey many years ago, not when he was representing students, but when he was representing some of the more accomplished pornographers. So I thank you for allowing me to review some of the evidence in those cases.
Now, of course, they're one and the same.
Right. Brief mention was made of the Obama administration's doings. Could you folks describe that? Because I'm not sure that people realize how the administration's gotten involved in these types of issues.
Are you talking about the Office of Civil Rights? Yes. Well, the Department of Education, so-called, has an Office of Civil Rights, so-called. And they have recently sent, about a year ago, they sent around the letter to the campuses saying that with regard to sexual assault and sexual harassment cases, and by the way, sexual harassment is a vast, sexual assault is a more limited category, but sexual harassment is a vast category, you know, ways in which men annoy women. That's an endless category. You know. And vice versa, of course, it's also endless, but that's not of interest to the college disciplinarians. But the Office of Civil Rights actually instructed college administrators that the standard of proof in sexual harassment and sexual assault cases should be not the way it is in the criminal justice system, proof beyond the reasonable doubt, not proof by any substantial amount of evidence, but rather a preponderance of the evidence, which means really 50.1%. What that really means is, if you've got a woman who says that she was she didn't give her permission, you have the man who said, well, she did give permission, you should be able to convict the man without being really certain of what the truth is. Preponderance of the evidence basically means you can flip a coin, which has a 50-50 chance of coming out one way or the other. That gives administrators total power, total control. You don't really need, and that's how you have Caleb Warner cases, where despite enough evidence to get the woman indicted for filing a false report, the school will not change its mind because evidence doesn't really matter. Ideology matters. Power over the students' lives matters. Truth doesn't have a role in this system.
And also, by the way, this letter gave accusers as well as the accused the right to appeal. So in this extraordinary system, if you're an accuser, if you lose under this very lax standard, you can appeal your loss. It's incredible.
You go from trying to deal with the whore to dealing with the madam, and the madam will probably reverse.
We have time for one more question. Yes, right in the middle of the woman in the multicolored top.
This is a question for Harvey Silverglade. I'm interested in your thoughts about the mental impact on the students that go through these oppressive and regressive institutions that American universities have unfortunately become. There is clearly a totalitarian mindset among these administrators, and I wonder if you could tell us what you think is the impact on these students. Do they come out as conformists? Do they come out as rebels? And what does that mean for the political future of the United States as a constitutional democracy?
That's the question. Yes, that is the most important question. It is the ultimate question. We are, all of us who are involved in this battle are involved in it because of what we know it is going to do to the country ultimately. In the beginning, the students saw right through it. And, I know because I've represented students since 1967 when I started out as a lawyer. And they saw through it when it started to happen in the 80s, the mid-80s. And for the first 20 years, the students really said, look, I just want to get out of this madhouse. I want my degree. I want to go on with my life. And, I have many stories I can tell, but I can't because the students preferred that I not. They just wanted to get out of this. And more recently, there's been a much more worrisome development. Students have started to talk just like the administrators. I'm an avid reader of the Harvard Crimson, and I've been very upset the last few years. I know I keep sending Greg copies of the Crimson, that the students are starting to imbibe this utter errant nonsense. And not only nonsense, but stuff that students 20 years ago realized was insanely unfair. Now they're starting to use the same language. It's very serious. That's the reason we're all working so hard at this battle, because of what it's going to do to the country. I used to say that you can say things in Harvard Square, which is the public area outside Harvard's gates, that you would be punished for saying inside Harvard Yard. And that was true, but now what's happening is that this square is becoming a little bit more like the yard. And that's what we've got to guard against.
Casey, you're teaching all the time, and so to the question, the psychological impact you see on students.
Yes, there's an additional impact as well, which is that if you're a student and you're inclined to try to challenge this system, it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, over the course of my career at Brooklyn, I've been really fortunate in that at various stages I've had students who have been willing to stand up for what's right. And I've mentioned this before, I'll mention it again, we are lucky because we have a really good CUNY administration and a CUNY board that has, in most cases, backed these students. We are the exception. At most institutions, Duke and Yale, which I've talked about today, the students would never get this support. And so you have this combination of students who are basically worn down or students who are willing to challenge and then get, you know, shot down by administrations that don't back them up.
My name is Greg Lukianoff, and I'm the president of FIRE. I've been doing this for about 11 years, and I'm coming out on October 23rd with a book called Unlearning Liberty, which is campus censorship and the end of American debate, because I believe this is harming all of us. This has been going on for 30 years. You can get in trouble for everything. But there's actually data on it, too. While I was writing the book, there was this huge study done by the American Association of College and Universities. It was trying to be a whitewash. There's no problem on campus, there's no problem with discourse on campus, but they ended up, I think the sample size was something like 21,000 students and faculty members that they surveyed, and they asked them this milquetoast question: is it safe to hold unpopular views on campus? Now, if you think about how that's worded, they are looking for everyone to go, well, sure, it's safe to hold, it may not be like okay to express it, I'm certainly going to watch my mouth. They were looking for an answer that everyone would say this is great. 40%, only 40% of college freshmen agreed strongly that it was safe to hold. Anything less than agreeing strongly is saying it's not. By the time they were seniors, 30% of them agreed that it was safe to hold unpopular views on campus. 18% of administrators agreed with it, and 16.7% faculty members. And part of my thesis in my entire book is the idea that not only is this hurting and fostering group polarization and causing us to form echo chambers, it's making us all just a little bit dumber. So anyway, I just wanted to, since there is actually data on that, I wanted to.
Well, look for references to that and to writing from Harvey Silverglate and Casey Johnson on Minding the Campus. I believe that we're going to transcribe and post these proceedings, so feel free to forward them to whomever you think would be interested. And please join me in thanking Harvey Silverglate and Casey Johnson.